Welcome to the Vernuccio Novak Report and the American Political Zone. From New York, this is Frank Vernuccio.
And from Washington, this is Daria Novak.
Daria, on August 30th, 2021, was the effective end of the Biden administration's respect around the world when the Biden administration irrationally and hastily pulled American troops out of Afghanistan. In the process, because it was so bungled, 13 American servicemen died. Hundreds of Afghans who were friendly to the United States were imperiled. And the almost impregnable airbase that we had at Bagram was let go. Most folks thought that even if we pulled our land forces out of Afghanistan, we would hold on to Bagram. We did not do that because of Joe Biden. The Chinese were able to have influence over it. And the Taliban, of course, took over. We left $1 billion worth of equipment or so for the Taliban. This month, the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, rather, honored the 13 U.S. servicemen who died because of the bungling of the Biden administration. And Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth has announced that the Defense Department will conduct a special review panel looking into the circumstances surrounding the suicide bombing attack on Kabul, Afghanistan, and the overall withdrawal of American forces from Afghanistan, bungled as it was by Joe Biden and his administration. It's a solemn fact. The complete dearth of any respect for the United States really can be dated right up until that time. And tragic consequences followed not only in Afghanistan, but I believe around the world as well. I hope the DOD, Department of Defense, has a thorough investigation, and I hope that no political considerations protecting Democrat members of Congress or the White House or the Biden administration, that nothing like that gets in the way of a thorough examination of what happened during that administration in August of 2021.
We need a solid investigation. Because this is not simply collateral damage from warfare. Yeah. This was unnecessary. It didn't
Completely.
Have to happen. The military in charge at the time and those under them, there were many that disagreed with how it was being handled. But many of the people that wanted to speak out had their voices squashed. I'm hoping now that we really get a good investigation that is not so politicized that people don't believe this investigation. And I think that means that the government has to walk a fine line. They've got to make sure it's very transparent. The records are open. There are more interviews that are done and done with the right kind of questions so that we get to the bottom of what really happened. You know, Frank, sometimes there's backlash and the Democrats will come out and say, oh, the Republicans are just conducting another investigation because of politics. They're trying to smear. We need to make sure this is important, it's significant, it has future consequences for pulling out from future events should something like this happen again. We need to really understand what happened, investigate what could have been done differently, and the reasons why. Who was in charge, for instance? If the president was ordering this despite what his military leaders were saying, somebody's got to be held accountable for this. People died.
Yeah. And I understand, too, the attitude of the administration was pretty horrendous to begin with. During the dignified transfer of the bodies of those 13 servicemen back to the United States, Joe Biden, who was supposed to be there as president, made his boredom known when he looked at his watch. Well, he should have been paying attention to this dignified transfer of dead American servicemen. So this is something that has to be analyzed from top to bottom. Get the politics out of it. Make sure something like this doesn't happen again. And I think two of the aspects, in addition to the question of personnel that have to be examined, is what in the world was the administration thinking when they allowed almost $1 billion of equipment to be given to the Taliban, when they allowed the almost impregnable Bagram Air Force Base to be left to the tender mercies of the terrorists and the Chinese? You know, this is a real crime in the man that we've seen occur. You can't let this one go. Yes, you're right, Daria. There will be charges of politicalization or revenge by the Trump administration. That's not the case. This is a serious matter. It requires the most intense examination.
If you're going to withdraw forces, you do not announce to the enemy what your time schedule is when you're either putting men in or putting or pulling men out of an air, men and women, obviously, but pulling people in or out. You make preparations so that those that were helping you in war, meaning those, for instance, Afghan translators, that they're taken care of, that they're protected. We have a responsibility to those people too. We saw cases during that withdrawal where some of our ex-special forces literally went into Afghanistan on their own and tried to protect some of these people and sneak them out of the country over other borders away from the airport, simply because they knew that these men and women had helped our forces in country and they were going to be killed if they were left there. The Biden administration didn't take any of that into account. This is including women and children that were involved. This is not combatants. These were people like engineers and others from Afghanistan that were helping the US military. There were so many foul ups on this, Frank. I don't even sure where you would begin this investigation. I think we really, really need to look at accountability from the top down. And some people will charge it as being political, but you know what? There's politics in everything. We've got to clear away that as the excuse and really look at what happened and how do we avoid having this ever happen again.
Yeah, and let's understand that this is not a case of first impression. If you recall, when Joe Biden was vice president in charge of Middle East policy during the Obama administration, he engaged in a precipitous pullout from Iraq, from the Middle East, which allowed ISIS to come into power. And it took the next administration, the first Trump administration, to actually resolve that disaster that Biden did as vice president in charge of Middle East policy. Also, you and I, Daria, on this program, interviewed during the Obama administration, what happened in Libya when the United States ambassador was killed, when members of the protective services begged Secretary of State, then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, to send reinforcements, and she refused to do so. Instead, made up some ridiculous lie about a video being responsible. When she ignored desperate pleas for help, and just as you mentioned before, Daria, when special forces individuals on their own went into Libya to try to rescue at Benghazi the forces that we had there, the ambassador we had there. Too late, of course, but nevertheless, this seems to be a real pattern with Democrat administrations. We need to get to the bottom of it. Now, Bagram, the Benghazi was bad enough. That was a horrible story. And we had, I believe it was Tonto, one of the Secret Service people there on the show, and he described how horrible that is. But in Afghanistan, when we saw 13 U.S. servicemen and a major strategic blow to the United States with the loss of the air base at Bagram, this is not only negligence, it's almost giving aid and comfort to the enemy. And I don't hesitate to use those words, Daria, that are the essence of a charge of treason.
It might really be. The question will be, can it be proven that there was malintent? It is treasonous, but for a legal definition. But Frank, if we look at this from the long term, what did the Biden administration think they were going to accomplish by this withdrawal? They destabilized the whole region. As you said, literally, arms were given to the Taliban, the people that were fighting against the Afghan people.
And the people, by the way, the people who bought you 9/11 here in the United States.
Exactly. I mean, you really have to think, what were they thinking? We saw when the Russians were in there were problems. They withdrew. You think that we would have learned some lessons.
No, that's absolutely correct. And again, what I find, it was bad enough when we had the surrender of pull out the way we did. But the surrender of Bagram Air Force Base is the most mysterious part of all this. It has to be investigated. Let's go to our first guest. Scott Walter is the author of Arabella, the dark money network of leftist billionaires secretly transforming America. Scott serves as the president of Capital Research Center and was in the George W. Bush administration as special assistant to the president for domestic policy. Scott, welcome to the program. It's great to have you.
Great to be with you.
There's a question that I've always had. It seems that every dinky little leftist group always seems to find ways of garnering huge amounts of money. Comparatively, when you have a conservative or Republican group, they can do enormous work and don't seem to come up with any funds at all. How do these leftist groups get these enormous sums of money whenever they seem to need it?
Well, first of all, you have to remember the left is the party of the rich. You have to say that because it's true and because it infuriates them. But second, there are some amazing networks on the left that help to spread those billions of dollars from the lefty, rich guys around. And probably a lot of your listeners have heard of the Tides Network, Tides Foundation, but a lot fewer people have heard of the Arabella Network, and it's actually the biggest of all, left or right.
It's amazing. We saw, for example, somebody like a Stacey Abrams who starts an NGO group with about $100 in the bank, and somehow she winds up getting a huge amount of money from the Biden administration in the parting days of that administration. Is there a connection? For example, if a group like Arabella or the Tides Foundation gives money to a left-wing group, are they eventually reimbursed to some extent by a Biden administration when it's in office, by a left-wing administration in office?
Well, yeah, in general, let me say you're absolutely on to the to another part of the truth, which is the left is also the party of government, and so a lot of your tax dollars do go to all kinds of lefty groups, both here in America and abroad, and that is yet another problem. And the lefties used to love to talk about the revolving door between corporations and government. And that can happen, but there's a lot that the revolving door is spinning a lot faster between, say, the environmentalists and the EPA and the Department of Interior, when Democrats, control those institutions.
Is it more than just money? We heard during the Obama administration that I believe a California billionaire named Tom Steyer effectively ran the Department of Environmental Protection without benefit of any oversight by Congress or any ratification of his position by Congress.
Well, as I said, the environmentalists probably have a revolving door that spins faster than anybody else. And Steyer and his groups have had huge effects on the federal government in that sort of way. And by the way, the Arabella, the founder of Arabella is Eric Kessler. One of his first jobs was at Clinton's Department of the Interior, another big enviro part of the federal government. And then during the Biden administration, he was effectively like the deputy secretary of agriculture. I mean, you would see emails from the secretary of agriculture to his senior staff, no outside people on that email except Arabella's Eric Kessler.
So we see layer after layer of hidden money that seems to somehow become clean and end up in campaigns. Are people tracing this at all to really look at who are the powers behind what's happening?
Well, at capitalresearch, org, we do our best to do lots of digging into that. There are some other good folks as well, Americans for Public Trust and others that are trying to follow these money trails. In the case of Arabella, one of their sugar daddies is somebody you probably have not heard of, Hans-Jürg Wyss. He is not a U.S. citizen. He is a Swiss national and a billionaire. And he has put over $500 million into left-wing nonprofits. And surprise, those nonprofits sometimes put money into Democratic political campaigns or into ballot initiatives, which of course have been the main way the left has been driving get out the vote in the last few years. So you have serious problems in this area.
So if we look at this money that is out there on the left, they seem to target campaigns. Like in Virginia here, we saw at one point the Democrats were probably going to lose, this is 2 or 3 years ago, a state rep position. And all of a sudden, $90,000 shows up for this small, small campaign. And donations and things like this, all hidden or multiple donations. It didn't fit the pattern of how people donate to what is virtually a local campaign of two or three towns. Is this a targeted policy by the left to go in and to just literally outspend conservatives or Republicans in distinct areas?
Let me just add something to Darius' sentiment. In New York City, there's a serious campaign for mayor by a confirmed socialist-communist, Mamdani. It was just revealed that the great majority of his campaign contributions don't even come from New York City. They come from outside. So to Darius' point, are we seeing targeted attempts by these millionaires, by these billionaires, rather, to warp elections?
Well, no, you certainly are. And by the way, that being the party of the rich means that you often will find Democrat campaigns getting more money from people out of state than in state. Now, keep in mind that in and of itself is not illegal. I wish that the conservatives were more effective and that sort of thing. And another, I don't know the particular Virginia race you're speaking of, but obviously Virginia has several Soros-backed prosecutors, right? Local prosecutors, and that's a horrible thing the left has been doing, and that fits exactly the MO of what you were describing, where there is a last-minute money bomb in what is a small local race. And surprise, it takes somebody over the finish line.
You're bringing up a great point. We're seeing in many major cities district attorneys who are engaged in activities which are certainly head scratchers, just letting criminals go right, left, and center. What would be the motive, though, of anybody, even a left-wing billionaire, into encouraging crime?
There's two answers to that. One would be perhaps they actually believe their own press releases and they think that this is, righting historic injustices and this and that. That might be. There's also the possibility, which decent people like yourself have a hard time allowing themselves to imagine, and that is, if you're letting murderers and rapists out on the street, it might actually be. Not that you're mis have a good intention, but a misguided understanding. Maybe you have a really bad intention. Maybe you actually don't like people very much and you want to take down the whole country however you can. There aren't a lot of people like that, but true radicals and extremists are bursting with hatred and nihilism and want to take things out. The horrific shooting in Minnesota. Right, which, like so many of them, ends in a suicide. Well, what's the point of that? Well, the only point is it was a nihilist bursting with hatred, with a head with all kinds of nutty ideas that had been put into it with the help of social media, and he does something unspeakable.
We're speaking with Scott Walter, who's the author of Arabella, The Dark Money Network of Leftist Billionaires Secretly Transforming America. On that very point, is it possible that these folks see this as a way of destabilizing the nation as a whole, and then we'll do what dictators always do, saying we're the only ones who can restore order? I find it fascinating when you have a city like Chicago or New York. When they want to take down the police department or defund the police and replace them with social workers, many of whom are very hard leftists themselves, is this an attempt to take out the institutions of our society and replace them with those who are politically beholden or agreeing to hard leftists.
Well, just the way you described that, right? There are many historical precedents for that kind of thing. The people who are constantly screaming to us that fascism and authoritarians descending upon us, well, that might be serious projection. They might, in fact, be the fascist authoritarians who want to, like the classic example of Weimar Germany, have chaos that terrifies ordinary people and makes people more malleable and willing to accept, as you say, some sort of order, which these folks believe they will be in charge of.
So, Scott, if we look at Tides Foundation and Arabella, can we find any patterns to the level of office? Was it state level? Is it federal? Is it a mixture? Are we seeing them go after attorney general races? Is there any pattern to what they're trying to accomplish, do you think?
Well, as far as the question of what levels they operate at, I mean, you can have Arabella fighting in an Anchorage, Alaska mayor's race or a city
Wow.
council race there. So, and obviously they fight in the presidential races. So there's pretty much no level that they're not, that all these bad actors are not acting. And then, but as far as a pattern, the most distinct pattern that to my eye is they are absolutely never for more responsibility, power, authority to local and decentralized institutions. They don't want Boise or Ottumwa to have more ability to shape, the people there to shape their own lives. They want to centralize power in Washington every single time.
Does this apply to the area of education, where we see boards of education to that level with influence in the school systems?
Well, it certainly does. And of course, that's one reason that leftists are always pushing for more federal dollars for education, because the more money the feds hand out, the more power they have over the people getting the money.
And recently, Randy Levine from the Teachers Union has made a major push to get involved in a lot of these left-wing causes. Have we really totally lost out on any con rational control over education due to the money from places like Arabella?
Well, I think the federal dollars are a bigger threat. And for that matter, also state dollars, where the unions are just as powerful in every state capital. The teachers' unions are as powerful in the state capitals as they are in the DC capital. If anything, probably more so, certainly in places like Illinois and New York and California. I would take issue with one thing. Those unions, it's very important to remember, especially now that some conservatives are starting to think like, well, we love the working families, so we've got to be friendly to unions. Like, I'm all for being friendly to working families, but the union leadership across all the unions, and especially the teachers union, they are pillars of the left, and for decades they have been funding every imaginable left-wing cause. If you think that the National Education Association, wasn't pushing crazy gender ideology 20 years ago, you're mistaken. They have been in every kind of political issue, not just helping politicians at all levels that are on the left get elected, but also funding the leftist activist groups on top of that.
So, if people are looking to their community and seeing who's influencing local politics, who's influencing local issues like school issues or environmental issues, how do they find out about all of this? So much of this money seems to be hidden. How do you protect your community?
I will say that our website, influencewatch.org, that is an online Wikipedia of the left. And it has literally thousands of unions, activist groups, the movements like Green New Deal and the rest. There's a huge amount of information about those groups. So if you are watching your, local political scene and you see groups being mentioned and this and that, that would be my first stop to find out more about what those groups actually are and who's sending them money.
Is there any effective oversight of groups like Arabella or the Tides Foundation?
Well, there hasn't historically there has not been effective oversight. I will tell you that I'm proud to say I had three congressional hearings just in the just in 6 weeks in these recent months here, and all of them were about lefty nonprofits, and every one of them was in a different congressional committee. And all told, I've testified about a dozen times the last 2 or 3 years to Congress. So Congress is increasing its interest in and knowledge of this left-wing infrastructure. I've also been asked to brief folks all over the current White House administration, both the White House itself and outside agencies. So again, there's more and more momentum to try to understand this world. It's very complicated, as you say, very hidden, to understand it better and to hold accountable anybody who is violating the law, or to at least cut off funding for folks who are pushing agendas that the majority of Americans would be horrified to know their tax dollars are supporting.
Do you think some of the left's success is because of a different culture that they have from that of middle America, the right, in the sense that on the left, it's almost a goose step mentality? You tell me to vote for it, I'm going to vote for it. I don't care if it's a bad candidate. They've got a D after their name. Therefore, I do it. I don't question it. I'm told to go to a rally. Therefore, I go to the rally and I support whatever the issue is, no matter what bus I have to go on, I'm with the guys to go do it. If you look at the right, to me, it's always been like trying to hold jello in your hand and close your hand. Conservatives go every direction. It's a free-for-all. We might fight among ourselves because of some small point. We're not controlled by one mindset. Do you think that that sort of, I don't even know what to call it, group mentality, I guess, collectivist mentality, do you think that that influences their successes in collecting money?
Well, I don't know that it's central. I'm not sure it's as powerful for collecting money as it is for collecting activist people, right? That's something that they completely are superior to the right, at organizing groups and then directing those groups in a very collectivistic way. So that's definitely a part of their success. Absolutely. They aspire to be part of a Borg. It's frightening, actually. Whereas we're, if anything, too individualistic on the other side. But I would add one other thing, which is our people are normal. Our people don't have, profound emotional imbalances that are always looking for an outlet. And our people have jobs and families and businesses, right? So you just literally have less time to do these things. Whereas if you're a never married 20 something with severe issues with your parents or whatever, hey, it's a great job for you to go out in the streets.
How much of this money is actually being used to pay the protesters who we see so much on TV?
Well, of course, that is one of the most secretive and darkly hidden things. But we absolutely know that some of those folks are getting paid. My personal favorite example of that, the group that was an Acorn group, if you remember the old Acorn organizations, the Missouri Acorn group that, of course, changed its name after Acorn became too toxic, they hired protesters for the Ferguson, Missouri marches. About the guy who killed the cop, and they didn't pay their rent-a-mob. So after the Ferguson protests, the mob went to the headquarters of the Acorn, local Acorn group, and demanded to be paid their mob money.
Absolutely amazing. Go on,
Frank,
Darius.
I have seen so many videos lately from different cities from these protest movements. And in the video, you see the same face wearing the same shirt. And I know that some of them are actually being paid, obviously. They don't just automatically happen to be in New York and Chicago and LA just and happen to join a protest. We're
Yeah,
seeing multiple cases.
at Columbia University, in the anti-Semitic, anti-Israel protest, a phenomenon occurred which was visible to the naked eye. When they did their tent city, all the tents were identical. They were all expensive tents. Now, I don't know whether the Columbia students are a lot different than I was when I was in college, but I certainly couldn't afford to go out and buy an expensive tent on the will, on just a drop of a hat. Are they funding those types of equipments as well?
Well, I can't claim that I can document for certain in that particular instance, but as you say, when there are 50 people with the identical pre-printed sign, right? When there are hundreds of tents that are the same, at the barest minimum, they're getting instructions, right? Like, here's where to click on Amazon to get your tent. That would be the barest minimum that's happening. And in fact, of course, we do know that in some of the anti-ICE protests and things like that, that there even are videos of the truck pulling up, right, with the dozens of pre-printed signs and this and that. So the left's organization for this is enormous, because they always want you to think that, like, my fellow citizens are upset about something. When in fact, it could easily be the same set of knuckleheads who were last year were protesting something completely different. They organize their people, and their people want to go out in the streets. Those are just key ingredients of what you see.
One of the things I find amazing is when they do man on the street type interviews and they talk to these young leftists, they really don't know why they're there. They can't express an answer to simple questions about a protest or a candidate that they support. I find that amazing. It tells me a story about why they're there, and it's certainly not for the cause or that particular candidate.
No, it's virtue signaling, right? I mean, I would love to have on the Jew hating type things like Columbia that you had there. I would love to have every person protesting required to write down, okay, you just chanted from the river to the sea. Which river and which sea?
Well said. Scott Walter is the author of an important book, Get It Before This Next Election, Arabella, the Dark Money Network of Leftist Billionaires Secretly Transforming America. Scott, we've only scratched the surface. Let's have another conversation soon.
I'd love that. Thanks again.
Take care. Thank
Thank
you
you.
so much. Yeah, it is absolutely amazing, Daria. And we appreciate Scott being on the program. The amount of dollars that are flowing around from these folks and not given any publicity. If you were a corporate big shot and you donate $100 to a conservative cause, you're likely to find yourself publicized with all sorts of name callings. If you're a corporate big shot and you donate $1 million to a left-wing cause, well, somehow you're a cult classic and no problem occurs whatsoever. We're going to go to
Yeah,
our
I
next
go.
guest. Judge John Wilson served on the bench in New York City. He has been both a prosecutor and a distinguished attorney in private practice. He is the author of several important books, including The Making of a Martyr, Not Wasting a Crisis, and The Hot House Flowers. John, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
John, we've seen a couple of cases just come down from Wash from the courts concerning tariffs, concerning other things. It seems that these cases are going to be pretty much overturned at the Supreme Court level. Is what these federal district courts doing simply attempting to slow down the Trump administration until the next election when they hope they can get more Democrats in Congress and eventually a Democrat in the White House?
Well, I hate to believe that of my fellow judges, but the evidence is pretty overwhelming that the majority of the decisions that have been going against the Trump administration are coming from Democrat-appointed judges. and that those Democrat-appointed judges have been misusing their authority. It's no coincidence that the Supreme Court finally had to review the use of nationwide injunctions and recently decided that the federal courts, who have been exercising this power for the last 80 years or so, suddenly it was determined they never had that power in the first place. It was something that they had adopted to themselves and was not questioned, mostly because the power was used very, and I'll use the phrase, judiciously. The courts did not throw those nationwide injunctions at litigants all the time. But ever since the first Trump administration, it became obvious that federal district judges were misusing that authority. And as the Supreme Court noted, that almost every initiative coming out of the Trump administration was met with a nationwide injunction within hours of it being even thought of. So the Supreme Court was forced to look at the history of this power and determine that no, the federal judiciary does not have any power to issue nationwide injunctions except in one instance, and that's where a class is certified in a class action lawsuit. Now, of course, within hours of the Supreme Court rendering that ruling, class action lawsuits began being certified all across the nation, and suddenly injunctions were flying around once more for these class certifications. Can it be a coincidence? Not likely.
So, John, we've seen a lot of name calling and accusations on both sides. It's a liberal judge, it's a conservative judge. How do we get to a nonpartisan judiciary again? It seems to me the media keeps claiming, oh, the reason is Trump is guilty of something or other, but he got off simply because it was a Republican judge. How do we get away from the idea that politics determines the outcome of a judicial decision?
I honestly don't know if we can. There's an old saying among lawyers that a good lawyer knows the law, but a great lawyer knows the judge. And so, unfortunately, there is a long history of judges trying to be fair and trying to be impartial, but letting their biases, one way or another, dictate what they do on that bench. It's a sad human fact. The trick here is to try to have judges who are not going to be so blatant in their bias and so unfair in their bias. We all have our biases. We all have our prejudices. We all have our own viewpoints on things. What we want and what we need to get back to are judges who can ignore those biases and rule impartially. Unfortunately, what you're seeing today is the judges from the Republican side tend to be constitutional conservatives. Now, I have to make a very clear distinction here for the viewers and the listeners. There's conservative judges, there's liberal judges. But what Donald Trump has been appointing to the bench are constitutionally conservative judges. These are mostly judges whose view is the original intent of the Constitution and any law that they're interpreting is to be followed. While many of those judges who are considered liberal, activist judges, are the ones who want to treat the Constitution as a living document and reinterpret the words of the Constitution every chance they get. The abuse of that progressive viewpoint has become apparent that more and more judges who take that activist viewpoint, they often interpret the law the way they want it to be. A
So,
constitutionally conservative judge is far more likely to look at the words of the Constitution or the law, apply it, and even say in his opinion, I may not like this. I may think the legislature should address this, but this is the clear import of the law, and this is what I must rule.
we have people today criticizing the Supreme Court. How threatened or how fragile is the situation at the Supreme Court level today?
I don't think the Supreme Court is fragile in the least. I mean, there have been challenges brought by activists, difference. I remember a couple of years ago during the first Trump administration, there was some attempt at impeaching some of the members of the Supreme Court or bringing discipline complaints against them for this or that. But none of those efforts have borne any fruit. The judges, for the most part, of the Supreme Court have been vetted, have been investigated, and are not selling their offices. They're not engaged in impropriety. They're not engaged in any immorality. And so the likelihood that they're really facing any serious threat is extremely low. Now, let me temper that with the thought that the Biden administration seriously thought about packing the court for a while, but they did not have enough support, even among their Democrat colleagues, to perform such an act. So I don't really think the Supreme Court is under much threat. You will hear in the press criticism, especially every time a decision comes down that the mainstream media doesn't like, but criticism doesn't equal a threat.
Were you concerned when major political figures like Chuck Schumer, Senator Schumer from New York, used phrases like if the Supreme Court basically doesn't rule the way he wanted, that they would, quote, reap the whirlwind? Were you also concerned when the Biden administration was very slow to provide Secret Service or provide any kind of police protection for judges, when in fact there were significant demonstrations and threats against those judges?
Yes, that of course is concerning. Any threats to the physical well-being of a judge is cause for concern because the judge represents society's rules. And for the Biden administration to not make every effort to protect judges, whatever side of the aisle they sit on, whatever side they are perceived as being on, it's a threat to all of us who sat on the bench and currently sit on the bench. So yes, that is concerning. But keep in mind that there are those who are watching out for the well-being of the judges. Someone like Chuck Schumer has just proven himself to be nothing but a bag of hot air. I mean, his reaping the whirlwind comment ended up being just another hollow statement, as so many of the statements coming from Chuck Schumer lately are just hollow and meaningless. So there was a point where he was taken seriously. And to be honest, I have a hard time taking anything that man says seriously. And I don't believe I'm the only one who feels that way.
Are we facing a problem that actually goes deeper than just the judges currently sitting on the bench? Are we looking at a mindset that's inculcated in our law students in radicalized law schools? Just as our colleges have been radicalized, so too have our law schools been radicalized. Are we producing generation after generation of attorneys who will eventually become judges in some cases, who have been radicalized before they even get to the practice?
Yes, that has been an ongoing problem now for the past 10, almost 20 years. We have seen the fields of academia taken over by those on the left. There are statistics now that some colleges don't even have 1% of teachers and professors who identify as being conservative, that they're pretty much lockstep in the same viewpoint. And they've been conveying that to their students. It takes a pretty strong mind among the students to reject that indoctrination. And unfortunately, not all the students choose to reject the indoctrination. Many accept it as their worldview, receiving that information from their parents before they got it from their professors. Yes, that's very concerning. We've talked about education on this show before, often, and have often advocated for a return to a more neutral system of education. Again, we all have our viewpoints and our biases. There's no denying that. But there was a time in this country when people could put aside those viewpoints and follow the law and just give you the facts and let you learn to think for yourself. That's no longer the case.
So, John, within law schools, some students end up going into public practice in the sense of becoming prosecutors. Others go into corporate law. Is there any bias of political bias, I should say, for students coming out of law school where some traditionally are heading to a corporate world versus, say, public prosecutors?
That's hard to say. Even public prosecutors today are come with a left-wing bias that they didn't have before. I mean, you look at some of the major city prosecution offices like New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, and their prosecutor, their district attorneys are all very left-wing Democrats, and as such, that they're using that bias to hire prosecutors who aren't going to follow the law, who are going to follow the law as they want it to be, as opposed to as it is, and are going to follow these new policies that these left-wing district attorneys are putting out there. So yes, that is an ongoing problem, no doubt about it.
So, if these left-leaning individuals go to work in as a public defender, how much leeway do they actually have? I mean, we hear stories of in certain cities, it's a revolving door for criminals. They're out the door. Can the prosecutors influence what happens a lot, or is it a little bit of influence?
Yes, prosecutors have a lot of influence. Prosecutors control the charges that are brought against the defendant. And it's up to the prosecutor to decide what charges are to be brought. And those prosecutors then can either increase those charges, reduce those charges, depending upon what the facts of the case justify. So a lot
So
of the. Go ahead.
I just have to ask this because of what I'm seeing in DC today, John. So do
Okay.
these prosecutors have the ability to say whether somebody who's 17 and committed a murder should be charged as an adult or a child and get a jury sentence of a slap on the wrist and a clean record after a few months?
No, that's where the laws come into play. The prosecutor may have discretion on what charges to bring against the particular defendant, but there are still laws that dictate who can be charged as a juvenile and who can be charged as an adult. Some of those laws have been changed. Washington, D.C., New York changed some of those laws. And instead of reducing the age at which someone can be prosecuted for a murder, now they're treated as a juvenile when they're at an age of 17, 18 years old, when really they shouldn't be considered a juvenile any longer. Once the law has been changed, the prosecutor is bound by that law. I heard the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, Jeannie Pirro, discussing this in a press conference, and her complaint was that she wanted to see the laws changed, but there's nothing she can do until that law is changed. This is the same situation going on in New York and other jurisdictions with the cashless bonds. The law was changed to take some of the discretion out of the hands of the judges in setting bond for a defendant. It's not taken into account anymore whether or not the person's a recidivist. It's not taken into account whether they have open cases pending. It's not taken into account many factors that normally would have been. And unfortunately, in New York, it was never the law, by the way, that public safety was to be a determining factor on whether or not bond is set in someone's case,
Wow.
strangely enough. But of course, public safety in the form of someone who doesn't return to court has been taken into account for many years. It's just not one of the enumerated factors. But by changing that law and forcing the judge to consider the least restrictive method of bail, now that's tie the hands of the prosecutors the same way. They can ask for bond, but the judge is going to explain to them that the law doesn't allow him to set that bond. And so the prosecutors have some discretion and some ability to pursue a matter, but they're still bound within the four corners of the law.
And in fact, when you talk about age of so-called minor defendants, there is a political movement on the left called Raise the Age. In New York State, for example, they want to raise the age, I believe, all the way up to 18 from, I think it's 16 now. So the
Yeah.
situation is actually getting worse, not better.
So you would think at this stage that the voters in these jurisdictions would have learned their lessons about these public safety issues. I mean, it shouldn't matter whether someone's a Democrat, a Republican, whatever whatever party they belong to should not matter when it comes to public safety. If someone is committing a series of crimes, if someone is going to your store and stealing from it every single day, and how are you supposed to stay in business? If someone is stealing purses from women as they're walking in the street, or stealing cars from people, how are you supposed to function day to day? And it's always been a mystery to me how the voters can tolerate this. And then you wonder why so many people are moving out of places like Chicago, New York, and Los Angeles. They instead of voting against it, they're voting with their feet.
How do you explain the what's behind the motive of somebody like the district attorney of New York City, who just seems intent on not prosecuting crime at all?
I don't know the man personally, so I can only speculate on what I believe his motives are. I believe that there's a twofold motive there. I believe that, first of all, he is a black nationalist, a radical black nationalist, and I think that he believes that he is doing right by his people, by blacks, by thinking that in the past the law was so slanted against a black defendant that now he's righting that ship and making the law slanted in favor of a black defendant. What he doesn't seem to care or understand is that many of the victims of these black defendants are black and minority themselves. And so you're actually screwing your own community, I think, with this conduct rather than and helping. The second fold is that the underlying principles of many of the black nationalists that I'm talking about are communist principles. They've rejected capitalism. They've rejected the social norms that society has followed for since the inception of the country, and they've decided that a communist methodology is more to their liking. So if you look at the writings of many of the nationalists of the past, they do have communist leanings there, and I think that's the second factor. They might not even be thinking those terms anymore, but if you read their rhetoric and then follow back, read the communist thought, you'll see the identity between the two.
When you have an individual, let's say in a jurisdiction like New York City, where the prevailing ideology is hard left, but you have one individual judge who wants to enforce the law as written, wants to protect the public. Is he subject to pressure from, say, the chief administrative judge to nevertheless be softer on criminals than he would otherwise be?
That could be, and I can give you a for instance from my own career. At one point when I was on the bench, I was handling the felony arraignments. That is when defendants were indicted. There was a part where I sat as the judge where the felony arraignment was heard. If somebody was going to take a plea, I could take their plea. I was an acting Supreme Court justice at that point, and so I had that authority. But I was greatly disturbed at that time by the gun law that had been brought in under Andrew Cuomo, because I believed it to be extremely broad. It only read it's a felony to possess a firearm. We're very anti-Second Amendment words to that effect. It just seemed to be an utter conflict with the U.S. Constitution. And so at first, I didn't want to take any pleas from defendants who were pleading guilty to that charge. I actually had a legal aid lawyer representing one of those defendants approach the bench and explain to him that I didn't think his client should be pleading guilty to a charge that I didn't believe to be constitutional. Now, of course, there had been no appellate decisions on this. There hadn't been any rulings from any higher courts. So I had a discussion with my chief judge about that fact, and he was correct. I'm duty bound by the law to take those pleas if that's the defendant's choice. But it was my own preference that I did not believe that these laws were constitutional. I still don't. But I'm bound by the rules that I swore to uphold. So I had to take those pleas. And so that's an instance of the chief judge having a discussion with me about this viewpoint and reminding me that I have my own obligations to follow the law and to follow what's on the books. So that's your example.
Judge Wilson's books include The Making of a Martyr, Not Wanting a Crisis, and Hot House Flowers. You can get them on Amazon, etc. John, thank you so much for being with us. We look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you very much for having me. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
And to our audience, thanks for tuning in today.
We welcome our newest radio affiliate in Tucson, Arizona at 95.5 FM and in Provo, Utah at 90.5 FM. We welcome Tucson and also Washington, D.C. at 96.7 FM, Las Vegas, Nevada at 92.1 FM, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, 1640 AM and 102.1 FM, Tampa, Florida, 92.1 FM, Ritchie, Florida, 88.3 FM, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 90.3 FM, Macon, Georgia, 810 AM and 98.3 FM, Boulder, Colorado, 100.7 FM, Long Beach, California, 101.5 FM, and in Pittsburgh at 107.3 FM. We're also available on the AMFM247.com, iHeart, Spreaker, and the Conservative Commandos. Tell Alexa to play the program. Tune in to our television show, The American Political Zone, on the AUN Network, Roku, and Public Broadcast TV. You can access either program on our website at usagovpolicy.com. Thanks for listening, and join us again next week. We're sponsored by the New York Analysis of Policy and Government, a division of the American Analysis of News and Media, Inc., at usagovpolicy.com and the Institute for American Politics. Email us at truthandradio@gmail.com and tune in to the American Political Zone television show, also on the AMFM247.com network.
Our producer and director is the brilliant Jeff Hansen.